Hello and welcome to the Linux Lads, home of the Spice Bag. As usual, I am Shane.
I am Connor.
And I am Mike.
Isn't he? So, as usual, we're going to start off with what we've been doing in the last week or so. Mike, I see you've been having a go at Godot.
I haven't been waiting, but I've been trying to learn again. I've tried it before and got as far as a bingo app for whatever reason. That was years and years ago, and now I've picked it up again. Obviously, I've forgotten everything, so I have to start from the beginning. And it's all good fun. It looks... I remember the UI being a bit junky, clunky and all that, but now it's really polished. And I should have probably started with the fact that Godot is an open source game engine and IDE, and they have got their own programming language. So for it's great for making GUI, well, a games predominantly, that's what it's meant for, but also like GUI apps. And I think you can even make web-based games with it.
Yeah, I've tried out Godot myself in the past. I did a few tutorials and stuff and tried to get to grips with it. Very, very interesting. Really cool project. I found out an interesting bit of trivia. Apparently, a lot of gaming companies, like gambling companies, like online poker and stuff, they're investing heavily in it. Now, don't quote me on this. I don't have a source at all. So, but... That's gas, because the other game engines, you have to pay commercial licenses. So they're using this open source game engine, which is perfectly capable of creating like 2D card games and roulette and stuff like that for their gambling sites. So, you know, there you go. it's not all flower child stuff with this Linux and open source crackola. But on my end, I've been still trying to just do something very basic that I think shouldn't be this hard, but get my two hard drives working in Pop! OS. I have an SSD and two kind of backup hard drives. And I just keep getting some really random systemd errors when I start up the system. It says it's like a start job is waiting for, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. There's a whole stream of text that appears, and I looked it up. I looked up all the error messages, and apparently it's some like upstream system debug. And it also has something to do with the fact that Pop! OS encrypts the hard drive partitions. And I think it's something to do with crypt swapper. I don't know. Something to do with encryption and the swap partition. I don't know. it's to do with magic, basically.
it's magic.
I tried a whole bunch of... but I tried a whole bunch of solutions. Like I went into the fstab file, or fstab file, I should say, and
people hate when you say fstab, so I use it all the time.
It just rolls off the tongue. I'm sorry. Some things just sound better that the way they're, you know, it's easier to say them. But like GIF. I'm only joking. I'd never say that ever. So I'm sorry.
You're off this podcast.
So what's with your stub?
My stub, I tried to, like, because there's this entry in the fstab file that I assume is decryption on the hard drive, or something to do with the encryption on the hard drive. But I swapped my hard drives around. I put that at the end, thinking that would solve it because somebody else did something similar and it worked, but no. It booted up once successfully, and then the second time it didn't. So yeah, I'm at a loss. I really don't know what the hell's going on. So I just plugged the hard drives out. I'm just not using them for the time being because it's just too annoying. So I don't think it's Pop! OS's fault. It's a great distro, but it's... Yeah, as I said, it's like some systemd upstream issue that is tangentially related. So, that's the end of my tale of woe.
Yeah, I mean, you would obviously fix it if you were just using Arch and Plasma. it was a joke, by the way. I'm using neither, so I just felt the need to say something smart, RC.
Yeah, it's just... I guess once you have that Arch tendency, it's very hard to shake, I guess, you know. Just Arch gets under your skin. gets part of your identity.
We could. I mean, to have a smooth segue, like something. What is not as bad as Shane's hard drive woes is the Blender Point 2.83 or something.
Yeah, that wasn't smooth. That wasn't a smooth segue at all.
It was because yes. I say it was.
Speaking of smooth segues.
The Blender 2.83 is...
So blenders make things very smooth, and you could probably make a 3D model of a Segway in it. So, yeah, Blender 2.83.
You just redefined the word strained to new level.
So Blender 2.83 is the first long-term support release of the application. And this is a big deal because they're going to commit to supporting it for at least 2 years. Like security, and you know what that means, but it's really exciting because it really opens it up to proper professional applications. Now I'm not sure, I'm not an industry guy, I don't really know how far along it needs to be, but it's pretty bloody feature rich, and it's a long-term support model now, so that means they're not going to be changing it up with point releases so much. I believe with this 2.83 release, they can be guaranteed it's going to function the exact same way for the next 2 years. Again, you know what a long-term support release is, but it's exciting because with Blender now, I think this opens it up quite a bit more to the professional world. It is used in professional effects and in effects houses and studios and stuff to a certain extent, but it hasn't really broken through to that full-on professional. It hasn't reached the heights of like Cinema 4D or 3ds Max or Maya or any of those, and all those tools that are used by like Hollywood films basically. So yeah, it's a really exciting time, and they've added like a shit ton of features. Like I'm reading down through the one pager here, and it's absolutely nuts. Like there's like all these crazy fluid simulations they've added. They've added VR capability that lets you model stuff and then like walk around it with a VR headset on. Like this like NVIDIA optimized like hardware acceleration that denoises your renders. Anyone who's tried to render anything in Blender will understand the pain of noise and how shitty it is. And cloth sculpting. I was like, what? There's so much cool stuff in here. So you guys say something before I just geek out about Blender for the next 20 minutes.
I'm at the part where it's towards the bottom where it says updated shader nodes, and then the rotate kind of smoky sphere thing that he's doing. I'm like, holy shit, that looks good.
Yeah, I mean, Blender is like absolutely bitching these days. Like, it's so good. Like, it's like people need to give it another chance, man. And once you take the time to learn it, it's about 17 programs in one. It's just bananas. I remember we had Mike Tunnell on before, and he basically talked about KDE for like 35 minutes straight. So that's me with Blender at these days. I'm only scratching like the first 5% of it, like if that.
Maybe you should appear on his podcast and just speak about Blender to return the favor.
Yeah.
His podcast is news, isn't it? So, but actually, and he's there by himself.
Or Destination Linux or something.
Destination Linux.
Yeah. So yeah, it's nice to have fanboys, you know, and I'm happy enough to be a fanboy of this program because it's incredible, quite simply put.
It's great that they are going for the enterprise, because that's going to give them longevity, that's going to give them stability, and as long as they keep like kind of translated it into and putting out open source releases for everybody to learn and become a member of the community. Because I think for projects like this, the grassroots are really important. They wouldn't be where they are if they didn't have the community. And if they were in here, the community would have not have a great video editor and whatever else it. It's not a sorry video editor. What am I talking about?
That's another thing they improved in 2.83.
Okay, so it has a. It's like It's like the Emacs of creative arts. Yeah, it has everything.
Yeah, yes, very well put.
Speaking of, Shane is like, speaking of things that are related to Blender, that is also in Blender.
does it have an email client?
Well, it does have like an API. You can write plugins for it, so maybe if you know Python well enough, you can write an email client for Blender.
Now there's a challenge.
You didn't expect that, did you?
No, I did not.
But it's crazy. It's a Python API, as I said. So that, you know, I know that appeals to a lot of people. Let's move on because I've talked about my stuff quite a lot. Mike, Microsoft's recent missteps in open source, should they know better by now, or should we cut them some slack? And I'm asking you directly because I know you're going to have an opinion on this.
I actually don't. That's what I'm asking. So Microsoft released a few really good news recently, but among those two, there were two weird ones. First one, they talked about, they renamed their project that does something like with GUIs, like for GUI creation, something to do with .NET and, Mono and stuff like that. And they called it MAUI, and there is a project, open source project that does GUI of the same name that saw it and was like, what? Because why would you do that? That was one thing they did. Like they basically took a name of a open source project that does a similar thing. And secondly, they released the package manager for Windows. Is it called Winget or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Winget.
And they basically took a project that existed and copied it, and it took them a while to admit it. Like, they took an open source project called UpGet, not UpGet, but UpGet. Again, I think that the question is, are they just not caring about the smaller projects, or are these just missteps? We obviously won't know. I think for me personally, it's just important that we point this out, right? So it's important to point out the good stuff about Microsoft, but not to be, we used to be very, very negative about them. Like, by we, I mean the royal we for me and the wider open source community. We used to be very negative about Microsoft for a long time, and they were partly to blame for that, maybe more than partly. And now I think when I listen to a lot of open like Linux podcasts and stuff, the tide seems to be changing. We just need to make sure that it's balanced. That's mostly why I'm mentioning these two things, just to keep the keel even, because it's a big company and there's no way in hell they will do just great stuff. Nobody does that, right? So we just need to make sure we don't overstep in the other direction and just. And not mention something bad that they did. Do you guys have an opinion on this?
Well, my initial thoughts in relation to the UpGet, Winget thing was that, just speaking in very broad terms, like Microsoft is a massive trawler in the ocean, so for it to change direction is going to take some time, and not all part of the organization is all going to turn at once. Is going to take a while for them to turn. So the captain or the CEO might know the direction that they're going in, and the people who are at the forefront of it, the developers and the tech savvy people in it, may know the direction that they're going in, but then it might take a while for the marketing guys and the sales guys to fully understand that the ways of old is not necessarily how we're going to do things in the future, and that this is now the direction that we're going in. I think we're starting to feel some of the growing pains of other parts of the massive behemoth that is like Microsoft, that they're all starting to get the message, even the not necessarily technical people, like the sales, marketing, or the designers who do the logos and the branding and the other parts of the organization. I mean, the way, I have no idea about the individual roles, but the way the person who's making the announcement in about Winget reacted to people saying, "Oh, but it's more or less just like AppGet." They are in a senior position, but they may have been promoted up the ranks in a different department. Like they might have a marketing background or something like that, and then they became more technical. So they're like, "Oh, you have the more technical prowess. So therefore, you can take the lead on some, or you can take more of these more technical presentations or more technical announcements or things like that." It kind of screams of an old mentality of, you do something that's similar to something that we have. Oh, that's cute. Well, our internal thing that we developed ourselves is that our internal guys have developed is automatically better than anything that you have done." Completely not getting the disconnect of, no, the internal guys pretty much base their entire project on the thing that you're just... So, yeah, it's the whole thing of, our stuff is automatically better, and they've no idea what the background in relation to it is. Those kind of growing pains I'm starting to hear, and that is my take on it, is it's just taking a while for it to filter down, and some of the marketing people might be used to that old way of doing it of, our stuff is automatically better than anything that you are doing, without actually fully realizing the history behind it. So then when there was the backlash and was pointed out to this person, they're like, so then they went into PR mode and said, no, that's not what we meant. What we meant was something different. And I don't think they understood the technical distinctions of what open source is, and the fact that, yeah, another project could do 80% of the work, and then you base your project on that, and then you make your own tweaks, and then rightly or wrongly you go off in a different direction, and maybe the original project wants to go off in a slightly different direction, but that's perfectly okay because it's open source, and as long as you acknowledge that your 20% customization on top of the initial 80%, which is the previous project, as long as you say, "Hey, this code is based off this project. What I'm doing is I'm doing these other things," and then you can see the code and you can see where. So somebody can make an informed decision if they want. It's a very alien concept, I think, to certain people in Microsoft. So I don't necessarily think it's malicious what they're doing. I don't think it's the old triple E, embrace, extend, extinguish. I think it's just taking a while for the message to filter down to other parts of the organization that open source is just a different way of thinking about things.
Yeah, it's not as like competitive almost. Yeah, like I know what you're saying. You have like these guys who think we're still running this like, you know, cutthroat technology company who needs to like be faster and better than everyone else, like, or else we die. Yeah, it's you have to kind of, they're hearting Linux now, so they've kind of adopted this, you know, totally different approach to how you make and distribute software. So yeah, it's kind of understandable that they're gonna make a few faux pas along the way. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, I don't know. It's, as you said, it's such a big company. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts. There's probably going to be some hands not knowing what the other's doing. So yeah, it is what it is, I guess, but I like the general direction that Microsoft's going in, and I don't think it's a problem really in the grand scheme of things.
I like the general direction as well. I just wouldn't want to be in the, you know, wouldn't want to be now like the Maui project thinking, so what are we gonna do? Are we gonna rename, or are we gonna just roll with it? You know, it's the next step for Microsoft, I think, would be, and that goes for any big company, would be to say, all right, well, we messed up, let's roll it all back and change the name. Or, you know, with the upgrade thing, that's they just need to acknowledge what they did, that they took, that, you know, they just need to acknowledge the person who created it. But with the name,
I think they're slowly starting to now, but it had to be pointed out to them quite stringently, I think.
Yeah, with the name of the project is different. It's something they should probably, in my opinion anyway, roll back. Maybe they didn't get enough backlash, and that's it.
So a quick, for people who don't know the background of the AppGet thing, I'll try to be brief. It's a Canadian developer, I want to say. He was working on AppGet. Certain people in Microsoft noticed that it's a really cool project and started to have conversations with him, like inviting him for a coffee, having a chat, that kind of thing, having discussions about packaging in Windows and where he felt there was bad points and like good points, and having that kind of conversation. Then they started having a conversation of maybe kind of taking him on full time, but there's a word that it essentially means that there's a word that escapes me at the moment, but essentially means that they acquire him,
aqua hire.
Where it's just him essentially. So they hire him, but it eventually means that he's now worked for Microsoft, and his project is integrated into whatever. But he's just paid by them to work on that project. So and then for some reason those talks just broke down for whatever reason. He went through a couple of rounds of interviews, for whatever reason they broke down, and also him being Canadian, he said he didn't really feel like moving over to Washington, where Washington State, where Microsoft is based, and then didn't hear from them for 6 to 12 months, and then the day before they made the announcement about Winget in their developer announcement, they got saying, hey, we got this new exciting thing and you might be interested in it and it's open source and maybe you'd like to contribute to it. And he's like, oh, okay, yeah, it's open source, maybe I'll have a look at it or whatever. And I don't think he actually, because it is up on GitHub, I don't think he actually looked at the code. I think the time that he actually found out about it was when they made the announcement up on the stage. And I don't know, during the announcement, did they mention AppGet? But I think it was around that time. They said, oh, and there's these other things available, as in AppGet, and there's a few, like Chocolatey and a few other things. And he said it wasn't the fact that it was based off his project, which is open source, that's perfectly fine, was the fact that, oh, here are some other things. And he was just one of them. Like, he was just mentioned as just one of the alternatives to this. And he's like, but this is 90% my shit. So that's what annoyed him more than, so the fact that they ghosted him for 12 months, which is fine, because he said that talks broke down, he made a decision that he didn't really want to be hired for them for whatever reason, so he wasn't pissed off at that, was the fact that he was just casually mentioned, oh, there's these other alternatives, but your project is pretty much 90% my code, kind of thing.
It is a bit of a dick move, in fairness.
My giving them the benefit of the doubt was my rant previously, that I just think that it's ignorance in a way of they're used to a certain way of doing things, and open source is a completely other way of doing things, so they're not used to giving acknowledgements to that degree. It's probably an alien concept to them that something that they're doing internally is based off something external, and they have to give an acknowledgement to the external person.
Yeah, it's like that scene in the first season of Silicon Valley, where they're going to all the investors, but they're actually like furiously writing down all their ideas just to steal them, and they're not actually going to invest at all. But yeah, obviously it's not that sinister. I hope it isn't. I don't know. So Linux's market share increased again last month. And you know, is it the year of the Linux desktop? I had to address the elephant in the room.
There was an announcement about this the previous month, and naysayers were saying, oh, it's naturally going to get a bump because Ubuntu 20.04 was just released. So the fact that it's happened 2 months in a row might be something interesting. People are speculating it's because, not necessarily because people are switching over to Linux in desktop Linux in masses, is because people are discovering WSL, so that might be contributing to the stats. So there's a few theories out there why this is. I mean, obviously we would like to think, people have discovered the true word that is the Tux operating system, and they're switching over to desktop Linux in masses. We would like that to be happening, but I don't think that's happening. So there's a few theories out there.
This market share, now I don't know much about how they measure this number, but one thing that stuck out to me was they said that they don't roll the Chrome OS market share into the Linux figure, which is good. Because obviously, yeah, Chrome OS is just Chrome OS. I know it's based on Linux, but you know, if you want to give a more accurate picture of the market share, then you have to kind of exclude the proprietary devices that happen to be based on Linux.
Do you mean Broken Gentoo? Yeah.
You what?
Chrome OS Broken Gentoo. It's based on Gentoo. I think.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh yeah, I heard that before. That's kind of cool in a way, but
I've just clicked through to their sources. So this is coming from netmarketshare.com, and I think it's going from how the browser is reporting what your operating system is.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not going to be like server farms or anything. Like, we're not interested in that. That doesn't come into the equation here. So yeah, because if we go to servers or enterprise, then it's going to be like inverted in favor.
Yeah,
like
it'll be 90% plus. Well, it wouldn't be 90% plus. I think BSD is actually is more than just 10% or something, but
you still have quite a lot of servers running Unix as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of servers running IIS. There's a lot of IIS servers.
In the website, it does say desktop/laptop, so they're not counting servers.
Oh, okay. They used to use a very batshit method of doing this. I don't know if they still do this, but it was basically the user agents. Like the operating system user agent header on all of the individual traffic hits or page impressions on like the five biggest sites on the internet. I think that's how they measured it. So it was like Facebook, Google, Amazon, etc., YouTube, whatever. Just they measured the user agent from those page impressions.
I don't know about that, because like that means that Google has to give you the data. And that's,
think they have another, I'm not sure.
There is no way you can get the data unless you are actually in charge of the servers. Right.
That's what I heard anyway. I don't know.
It's possible that Google shared it somehow.
Maybe I'm misinterpreting what I heard. But yeah. I don't know if that's how they do it. I don't know where they even get that information. I think you're right. I don't understand. Like, unless they're hacking into everyone's server logs. I don't know.
I don't know if... So if they go just by user agent, then there's an awful lot of robots who pretend to be specifically Windows desktops who would just have that, who would just have that, like, Windows 10 user agent. So God knows...
That's why I was saying it's a bad way to do it. Like, it's because that's not reliable. So I'm just wondering if that's still how they do it.
There's a methodology in here.
I've just been dicking around on the website while you guys have been talking, and they also do it for search engines. So I did search engines for that was last month. I was just checking so Google is 67.14%, Bing is 14.63%. Baidu, which I only can assume is the Chinese search engine, is 14.22%. So Baidu, in presumably just China alone, is nearly the same statistic as Bing globally.
I'm surprised Bing is even that high.
Well, so... Just about the methodology, they collect data from the browsers of site visitors to our exclusive on-demand network of analytics and social bookmarking products. So they could get data from like YouTube and Facebook, I think, as long as their stuff is included on there somehow. So they would be getting data from the browser sessions. And I don't know if, but still, like, you think Google, Facebook would have to allow them in, or maybe it's somehow sharing. I don't know. Anyway, it looks like it's more, there's more to it than, and they also talk about bot and fraud protection. So hopefully they would. This kind of thing is similar to what I do for work, and it's internet traffic is messy. To make sense of it is a job and a half.
Yeah, so I wonder. Yeah, it's interesting to think about, but anyway, to go back to the the reasons for the increase. I know it doesn't sound like much. It's only like a fraction of a percentage, but I guess it went from 2.87 to 3.17. So yeah, I mean, it's I guess that represents quite a lot of people individually, but yeah, just I was thinking what the hell could be driving that, and WSL seems like a good candidate, but in those numbers, I mean, that's quite a significant increase of the original percentage. So you know, relatively, it's quite proportionally, it's quite significant.
I just put a spanner in the works of the the internet browser user agent theory. How would they know that you're on WSL? Well, are you running a browser in WSL?
Exactly. Does it take virtual machines into consideration? Like, does it? That's all I can think of right now.
I can't think of anybody running a web browser in WSL.
Yeah,
or is someone actually juking the stats by like running like a fucking bare metal hypervisor with like 1,000 instances of Ubuntu running constantly?
I think more to this could be that COVID, the lockdown basically means that a lot of offices didn't open, a lot of people didn't turn up for work.
I like that theory.
And a lot of PCs didn't get turned on, and those PCs would be typically running Windows, so the Windows usage would go down.
Yeah, that's actually, you could be right.
They're running Linux at home,
or nothing, right? So these people wouldn't be might be furloughed. So instead of them running, going to work and opening Windows PC, they'd stay at home and watch Netflix on their Roku box or something, not trying to make light of anybody's bad situation, but that could have happened. That the office PCs that normally get turned on every morning for every weekday, they just don't these days. So
if that's true, then the iPad statistics are going to skyrocket because all the blonde soccer moms in America are going to be watching things on their iPad rather than be browsing on their work computer.
Well, then I don't know if... So that depends on the methodology. I think that depends how often they record. So if they... Yeah, and when... Well, anyway, I think every little increase is good for us. But I'm pretty sure this can go down anytime again. Like a community, we are very loud, but we are quite small. Although, to be honest, 3% of all usage, that's nothing to scoff at. That's a decent bunch of people, like decently sized bunch of people, you know?
The number of people in the world who actually own a computer is surprisingly small, though.
That's very true.
And then there's even fewer... Probably, actually, more people own a smartphone than own a computer in the world.
That would make sense.
That
one
would make sense.
Which is, and so people with access to the internet, obviously outnumber people who actually own a PC in their house or even a laptop, I reckon.
And a lot of,
I mean, there's countries in the developing world, particularly Africa, that completely and utterly bypassed the PC age. So now for them. They're starting to get wealthy, and they're starting to be able to afford luxury items like electronics and things like that. So, and the time that they're getting to that stage is completely after the whole PC age. So them, they want to get on a smartphone, they want to get a tablet rather than they want to get a desktop or they want to get a laptop.
There are certain places in the world where it's absolutely, you can't live without a smartphone, like Shenzhen and Shenzhen. I don't know how I'm
Shenzhen. I think. Well, I'm probably even butchering it.
In that city, you literally pay for like everything with your phone and QR codes, and like the city bikes, like vending machines,
we pay,
sorts of things,
and they've gone completely.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Utterly...
It's crazy. Another place is Kenya. Kenya is huge on mobile payments.
But those are not smartphones. I think these are...
I'm pretty sure it goes through SMS.
Well, yeah, it's a carrier-provided service. Yeah,
but that's technically not a smartphone then.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It's not a smartphone.
Mobile, it's a mobile phone.
It's a mobile phone, yeah. Which
but
makes sense.
Crazy to think of. You know?
Well, it kind of makes sense in countries that have got a huge distances. They are not exactly the safest, and everything to move money around is very expensive. To use something they already have in place, where you know the marriage between a mobile operator and money transfer company is actually they got close. So,
I think the reason why what you guys were talking about in places like Kenya and things like that is the reason why KaiOS in India and these places in Africa that we're speaking about is the reason why that got a surprising leap in market share, and it's in those areas where they don't have the disposable income to afford a smartphone, but they have disposable income to afford a dumb phone, quote unquote dumb phone, with some smart features. So much so that like they've ported things like WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger and things like that to something like old T9 layout phone.
Yeah, I mean that's just like giving the poor people something else to be angry about is like I don't know. I guess Facebook and WhatsApp are extremely useful, and it's cheap communication because in places where phone calls and text messages are not as cheap as we are used to here, and Geo, the company behind KaiOS, I think they kind of revolutionized communications in India when they introduced like VoLTE. Basically, you can talk over data, and instead of paying for minutes, you pay you pay for the data, and it's much cheaper that way. So it's interesting that in some place that sometimes progress is not is driven in countries where you wouldn't expect it. How did we even get in this topic, like from Linux market share to?
I was just thinking that the very idea of charging for SMS is pure profit for the network, because it costs them.
Oh yeah, it costs them.
It's pretty much free to them. Like it costs them .001 cent or something like that. What they figured out, the old technology of it, is the messages that your phone sends to the tower and then replies back in the old 2G days, the old where are you, I'm here, where are you, I'm here, that kind of thing. They found out that there was a bit of extra free space at the end of those messages, and that's the reason why SMS was restricted to a certain amount of characters. So that's the reason why it cost the network, even back in the 2G days before 3G happened, was a thing. Even back then, it cost the network virtually nothing because your phone was doing it anyway. Of the whole thing of
it actually made it cost negative money.
Yeah, so the and back then they were charging, and some companies still do it, like they were charging like 35 cent per text message or something like that, and that was 35 cents of pretty much pure profit for them.
I think we all remember those days when, you know, everyone was on, you know, Meteor or whichever network was doing the unlimited texts for €20 a month, basically.
That was three, I think. I can't remember.
It was before that. It was Meteor. Oh, was it? Everyone was on Meteor.
Back
in the noughties.
I remember paying 400 corunas for. Yeah, that's I don't remember what it used to cost, but it was really expensive to send a text message or to make a phone call from a mobile phone.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Or
on some networks it was like 50 cent or
something. They wouldn't charge you anything, or they would charge you a very small rate, like 3 cent or 5 cent if you're texting within the network. But if you wanted to text another network, then we're going to charge you through the nose. And I think Meteor were the first people to say, no, you can text pretty much any network for the same rate, and then all the other ones follow suit, except Vodafone, because Vodafone won't freaking charge you an arm and a leg no matter what.
Yeah,
it's gas how, like, the youth in the, I don't know, it, I think it's probably the same in places like America and the UK. I think mobile plans work a little differently in the US to here, but I know in the UK and Ireland anyway, like, it was always the network that gave the young people free texts or free calls or something, like for a flat fee a month. Like, they were always the one that set the pace for the rest of the industry.
What's very strange in America is the way it was set up, and does not make any sense to me whatsoever, is in America they cannot distinguish between a landline and a mobile phone. It's the exact same number. The way, the fact that, you know, we have 08 whatever, and we can say, oh, that's clearly a mobile phone number. To them, it's the exact same number. So the phone company cannot distinguish between the two. So they actually they started off, because mobile phone calls were more expensive to the network. They started off charging you for receiving a phone call. But because they can't distinguish between a landline and a mobile, they started charging the landline people for receiving a phone call. That makes no sense whatsoever. How could you charge somebody for receiving a phone call?
They used to be that way on some plans, but that kind of went out very quickly. Yeah. Like, the only time I would ever be charged for receiving a phone call was when I was on holidays,
when you're roaming,
and I was roaming or something. That's when Rome, before the EU came along and made roaming slightly more reasonable.
Actually, roaming these days within the EU is completely the same as except for data. So everything else is the same. And data, you get an allowance. So if you get unlimited, you might get like 8 gig. And no one's charging you for anything. Like the EU actually, like at least within the EU, it's all good. It's the roaming, I think, is exactly the same as if you were in Ireland.
Yeah, you get a, nowadays it's fine, like they made it way better, but the original plan was to have it like completely open, basically like a unified EU cell network. Like there were all different networks in each country, but you had to allow a subscriber in one EU state to be able to use their minutes or their plan exactly the same in another country. But then the telecommunications industry lobbied the EU like fuck, and they managed to delay it for a few years, and then they backpedaled on it and they said, all right, you get a certain allowance of your data that you can use in another EU country without any penalty or without any roaming charges. But I think your phone calls and your texts and all that, like that's kind of not charged extra.
Yeah,
I believe.
I think it's the same rate as if you were calling within your home country. If you're calling, so if you go to holiday to France or whatever, and you call back to Ireland, I think that's the same. But if you were calling, I'm not sure what happens if you are in Ireland and call a French number from an Irish mobile. It gets complicated, but it's much better than what it used to be. I remember switching data off for roaming because just it was too expensive.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like I just, like when I went to America, I could, like, roaming was crazy expensive, and I literally just go around looking for a Starbucks just for the free Wi-Fi and just stand outside. Like,
oh yeah, if I was going over to the States for any reasonably long period of time, let's say 2 to 3 weeks/more, I would just get a local SIM. There's just no point.
Yeah.
We're not sponsored by Ting, by the way.
Anyway, shall we talk about Linux again, guys? Speaking of mobile, this is actually a good segue for once. The Pinetab is ready for order. Haven't looked at the pictures myself, honestly, but I'm going to assume it's great.
It's meant to be it's meant to be $99 or plus $20 extra if you want a magnetic keyboard.
That's backlit, which is actually quite interesting.
Yeah, it's a great price for a tablet.
Interesting feature, yeah.
The specs are 10.1-inch IPS, 1280 by 800 resolution, quad-core 1.2 GHz CPU, Mali 400 GPU on the chipset, 2 GB of RAM, which is low, 64 GB storage.
LPDDR3 as well, it's not DDR4, but I guess that's forgivable. It's cheaper anyway.
It has got some ports, including an audio jack and a full USB 2.0. And HDMI, micro HDMI out.
It has a courage port.
It has a courage port, yes. That's it. and most importantly, it has got Linux, proper Linux on it. So it comes with Ubuntu Touch, but I think at this point there are other operating systems available, and those are Postmarket OS and Arch Linux for ARM. Mad props to them. They said they would, and they did. They delivered. Well, they haven't delivered yet. You need to order it first, and then obviously the price goes a bit up because you need to pay for packaging, and it's going to time to arrive. But if anybody is in the market for a cheap, very cheap, and okay tablet that runs proper operating system, then this is it.
Think of this, like $99 plus change gets you a really cool smart picture frame.
Really?
No, I mean that seriously. Yeah, for sure. Like, that's so handy if you think about it. That's Like, you could, like, just put that, like, Velcro that to the front of the fridge, just use it for notes, use it for just a weather readout, you know, just see what the weather's going to be like, have that up, have your calendar just displaying on it all the time. I mean, if you've got a spare 100 quid, I mean, why not? When you convert that to euro dollars, it's probably going to be like around the 120 mark ish with all the packaging and postage and whatnot. So, you know, and it's a deadly little touchscreen display for your projects. So you could just have it like a kiosk kind of thing just around the house. Yeah, it's really cool. And the I.O., that's the other thing I wanted to get to. The I.O. is crazy. What the hell? A full-size USB 2 port on a tablet. That is inspired. I just wanted to say that. And as you said, Connor, a Courage port, a 3.5 millimeter audio jack. There is still goodness in the world. Micro HDMI, which is bananas as well. Like, what?
And rounding it up, one micro USB with OTG support and a micro SD card slot, which is bootable. The storage, the internal storage is 64 gigs of eMMC, so you won't be using the micro SD card for storage, but you might flash the micro SD card with an image and then install it then onto the eMMC eventually.
64 gigabytes is not too bloody shabby for a tablet, if you think about it.
And a 6,000 milliampere battery. That's actually quite large. So,
and I'd say because of the lower power requirements and the kind of less powerful CPU, it will probably last you quite a while. And an optional M.2 slot. Holy hell. Yeah, I'm getting one of these things.
Yeah, I haven't used a tablet in a long time.
I recently purchased a tablet, as I was telling you guys before we started recording. I got like a very sexy Samsung Galaxy Tab, really big one. I really like tablets myself. I don't know, I just find them easier to, just for certain things, they just make life a lot easier. But the surprising thing about this one is that the speakers on it are crazy. And I never ever thought that a tablet could have good speakers and good sound. But yeah, it's got like AKG sound on the tablet. And I actually just find myself using it just to listen to music because the speakers are so good. So anyway, we're veering violently off course again. And let's bring it smoothly back to Linux.
Lenovo brings Linux certification to ThinkPad and ThinkStation workstations, easing the deployment for developers and data scientists. I have heard about this. This was a very, very good, announcement. I think was there a further announcement after this? I don't know if it's if it's in this press release, but they're saying that they're going to be supporting, Fedora and Ubuntu LTS. Yeah, I think, no, I'm reading through the article. I think they're supporting Fedora and Ubuntu LTS.
This is like full on wholesale adoption by Lenovo of Linux, multiple Linux OSs on their like fleet of laptops and workstations, which is that's pretty great news.
That will drive the Linux market share up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, ThinkPads have always had good Linux support, but I don't think it was by design, or maybe there's just somebody who's silently working in the background. The reason why it pretty much used to have only Intel internals, in other words, Intel CPU, Intel graphics, integrated graphics, and Intel wireless, and the Intel drivers for all of those tended to be pretty good under Linux. So if you just bought a ThinkPad that had just Intel all the way through, then it was pretty much guaranteed to work pretty well in Linux anyway. But at least you know it's official now, and it will be available on the website for enterprise and workstation type purchasing, probably bulk order or something like that. But it also means that they would have support. They will have a telephone number that your CEO can yell down the phone at if he's having issues with his laptop or whatever. And I've also heard that they have aspirations for, I don't know if it's a part of this announcement, but they have aspirations for porting their in-house applications for their like battery management and things like that, that they kind of install on Windows operating system, and porting those over to Linux as well. So you might have a nice GUI app that Lenovo make for your fingerprint reader for your workstation laptop or something.
The gas thing is that I have two Lenovo ThinkPads in the house. I've got a T450 for my own use, and then I have a T470S or some shit like that for work. They're both very, very similar laptops. They're identical looking, but I actually have more random glitches and kind of, you know, hardware incompatibility warnings, and what, like the Thunderbolt functionality on the work one, for instance, always gives me hassle, and I basically can't use one of those dock things, like with the type C cable, which would be very useful if I could, but I can't. Yeah, I just find that all the hardware works, and all the specific keys that Lenovo have, all the function keys and stuff, they actually work a lot better on Linux. So I don't know. It's pretty crazy. Like, you're talking about all the Lenovo specific stuff for the battery management.
Oh, did you say that for work you're using Windows or? And that's giving you, oh, because you didn't say that. So the Windows Lenovo is giving you more issues than the Linux one.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it? Nice. Well, nice. I'm sorry yeah, you have exactly. issues, but yeah. at least it's not Linux. I saw here, so we talked about the market share before, and they actually quoted this here in the, you know, so the story that Connor put into the show notes about the Linux certification to ThinkPads, more than 250 million computers are sold, blah, blah, blah. And they say that 2.87%, so they have all statistics of users, are using computers to run Linux, and they say that it's 7.2 million users are basically using Linux, which is a lot of people. I mean, that's roughly the size of Ireland and population.
That would be larger than the entire island of Ireland, including the two countries that are on this island. I think roughly the Republic of Ireland is about 4.5 million or thereabouts, and then the North would bring it up to about 6 million, I think.
Ah, okay, so I was widely off. So it's a lot of people. It's a lot of people that are using Linux. If we all could come together and have a meetup or something, that would be interesting.
7.2 million people, yeah.
It's just, you know, that's smaller than some cities on the island, right? So you could basically just kick everybody out of London and put them and fill it up with Linux users, and you'd be pretty much on the same level, I think, maybe.
Yeah, we'll all meet in a field in Canada, because that's the only place that would have
what
the space.
Would be the, what would be the biggest Linux organized meeting in the world, do you guys think? I mean, there's like OSCon or something, isn't there? That's pretty big.
Southern California Linux Expo, maybe.
Yeah,
Scale. Yeah, Southern California Linux Expo, I think.
I think FOSDEM is small fries compared to some of the conferences they have in the States. FOSDEM is quite big, but it's probably definitely the biggest one in Europe, I'm sure, but I could be wrong. The bloody queues at it would tell you that it's the biggest one anyway.
You know, the thing that Scale kind of works, Scale of Things kind of works, like there could be a meetup in Shenzhen that has got much more people than your FOSDEM by the factor of 10.
Speaking of the scale of scale.
There could be a book club in Shenzhen with more people. So that about wraps it up for our rather chaotic news section. Oh no, we're not calling it a news section anymore, are we? Events. Joe Ressington, the man himself, announced that there is going to be like a Fast Talk Lite thing. It's going to be basically a mumble call where everyone's just going to hang out online, do something like that. You know, nothing formal, I believe. You know, I think he mentioned before he's not interested in doing like a Zoom meeting version like everyone else is doing. So, which I understand, like, it's all about everyone being there in person. It's you know, we spend enough bloody time online, like, we communicate almost exclusively online, the bunch of us, so, even before the pandemic, before it was cool, so, it's just to connect, I guess, and just say hello to each other, which is totally, totally cool, totally fine by me. Socials, as usual, you can get us on linuxlads.com/telegram if you want to join our Telegram group and talk to us in the flesh, but not really in the flesh. you can get us on Twitter at linuxlads. You can get us on email us at show@linuxlads.com. You can find us on Mastodon, linuxlads.com/mastodon. And you can also donate by going to linuxlads.com/support or /beer or /donate.
Because we love all of those.
We
things.
Love aliases. Don't we?
I was just reading the Fostock announcement on the Twitter, and the amount of people were replying to him saying, "Oh, it's starting at 7 PM. What time zone?"
UTC.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean GMT?
England time.
Yeah. Greenwich Mean Time.
No, that's not cool to say that anymore. You have to say UTC. Universal.
Yeah, UTC stands for Universal Coordinated Time or something. the English got the meridian, the French got the abbreviation. Like, that's, yeah. It's a bit like Concord.
Yeah, the Concord, the Sega Dreamcast of the skies. Anyway.
Okay.
I thought that would be funny.
I'm sure there was going to be a noticeable increase in Twitter traffic just before it happened. So, that.
Yeah, if you're hooked into our world at all, come along and listen in, and we'll see what happens. let us slam the lid on the jar that is this hot mess. And I've been Shane.
I've been Connor.
And I've been Mike.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, Hedy and Mike.
All right, see ya.